so I face the final curtains.
My friend, yes, I am here. I hope it's clear.
And I switch my gaze, on which I'm certain I've lived
a life that's full of love.
I've traveled each and
every highway. Yeah, yeah.
And this much more than that I did in my way.
Given, given, and so kaput, kaput. The silent shock, shock, shock of these I had. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Not yet, build on the school.
बीच में गड़बड़ गया।
Championship. BBC News.
In half an hour, the British Council and BBC Persian Television are two of the examples in a study of cultural diplomacy. Both organisations deny that they're doing the work of the British government. They say they are independent through and through. And yet, the British Council offices in Kabul have been bombed, and the BBC is accused by Iran of spying. So how have our cultural institutions become mired in foreign policy? That's the question that Francis Stoner Saunders will be posing in tonight's edition of Analysis, which you can hear in half an hour. But now, Misha Glenny, the BBC's former Central Europe correspondent, presents the second programme in his series, The Invention of Germany.
High up on the 18th floor of a Berlin skyrise, I'm talking with Michael Stürmer, distinguished academic and former advisor to Helmut Kohl. Together, we're discussing the importance of geography in Germany's fragmented, troubled past. Our room has splendid views over the city that day, making it difficult to see this region as he was describing it to me. The chessboard, the turntable, the stomping ground of Europe. And he wasn't even talking about Germany's involvement in two horrific world wars.
Well, let me remind you of a church in Koblenz, the Castor Church. And in front of the church you have an old fountain. And the fountain reminds people of the Grande Armée of Napoleon, dated 1812. Then there's another inscription, seen and approved by us, le commandant russe de la ville de Koblenz, the Russian commandant of Koblenz, and it's dated October 1813. You have this problem of the neighbors and this eternal problem of the natural borders. There you have it in a nutshell. God has not created all countries equal. Some are more equal than others. Some are more privileged than others. You have to take geography as it is. It depends what you then make of it.
Today, Germany is Europe's most powerful state. But in this series, I've been exploring what it was like before 1914. Last week, we heard how in the 17th century, the Swedes swept down from the north.
In Germany, you have songs for children where the Swedish are the enemy. So if you don't go and sleep, the Swedish will come and take you with them.
Simon Winder, author of Germania, backs this up.
Germany is very much sinned against rather than sinning for much of its history, I'd say, that countries like Sweden and France were able to intervene more or less at will on a more or less prostrate series of mini-states. It's everyone's turn at some point.
Professor Norman Davis is author of Europe, A History.
Very difficult at those times to think of Germany having a future of great unity and economic power. Germany, in many ways, was retarded.
And this profoundly affected German nationalists in the 19th and 20th centuries because it was viewed as being, this is what happens if you have a helpless Germany.
So in terms of the people that we consider to be Germans, the impact is essentially one of profound humiliation and despair.
It takes generations for Germany to recover in any way at all.
The story from this point on has traditionally been told through the inexorable rise of one state, Prussia. Even today, the word Prussia still conjures up images of iron crosses, spiked helmets, officious bureaucrats, and war. Germans themselves have not helped in dispelling this lopsided myth. The year is 1933, just 2 days before Adolf Hitler and the Nazis seize outright control, and an aging President Hindenburg is about to welcome the Führer to the highly symbolic tomb of the fabled Prussian leader, Frederick the Great.
Der Ort, an dem wir uns heute versammelt haben, mahnt uns zum Rückblick.
The place, he says, where we meet today compels us to recall the Prussia of old, which became great in the fear of God through obedient work, never despairing courage, and devoted love of the fatherland. On this basis, it united the German tribes. Just 16 years later, in 1949, the Allies in Berlin formally declared Prussia dissolved and dead, consigning the entire history of this state to disgrace and shame. But what is the true history of Prussia? And was it really as German as we think? Norman Davis's latest book is called Vanished Kingdoms.
You see, everything has been coloured by the 19th century, telling us that the Prussians were Germans. Well, Albrecht von Hohenzollern, who created the Duchy of Prussia in 1525, he was more Polish than German, like all his maternal side. It isn't just a German story, although 200 years later, when the Hohenzollern historians are told to write it, they write it, as it were, about German virtues and the success story of a German nation. Well, it's not quite like that at all. Prussia was very tolerant, was very diverse.
This view of Prussia has huge implications for how we think of Germany today. For example, while we know that Adolf Hitler was obsessed by Frederick the Great, the Prussian leader from 1740 to 1786, and whose portrait even hung in the Berlin bunker where Hitler shot himself, it would be completely crazy to draw any meaningful line between the two of them. The state Frederick was trying to create was peaceful and enlightened. What he wanted more than anything was to create a cultural hotspot.
And nowhere is this more apparent than here, at the castle or palace of Sanssouci in Potsdam, where Frederick the Great took his court about 25 miles southwest of Berlin and created this extraordinary garden with its gorgeous terracing, English landscapes, Mediterranean landscapes, because what he wanted to do was not only demonstrate that Prussia could compete diplomatically and militarily with other powers in Europe. He wanted to show that Prussia, or this little sandy country, as Voltaire described it, could compete on a civilizational level.
Frederick surrounded himself at Sanssouci with an entourage of philosophers and musicians. He was a prolific composer himself.
A trio sonata in A major by Frederick the Great of Prussia.
He also described the German language as semi-barbarian, something Hitler clearly overlooked. And he wrote, in French, a treatise on the nature of kingship called the Anti-Machiavel, which sought to reject the dark arts of Machiavelli's The Prince. Torture was abolished, religious tolerance allowed, and a progressive, enlightened state was his obvious aim. But Professor Jeremy Black, author of 18th Century Europe, is keen to draw attention to another side of this early Prussian king.
Frederick the Great is, by any standards, an uneasy, difficult, rather peculiar individual. And his father was the source of many of Frederick the Great's problems. His father, a great military figure in his own mind, and certainly a dedicated militarist, did not like what he saw as his son being a bit fey, a bit aesthetic, probably a practicing homosexual, which certainly did not endear him to his father. He had poor relations with women. He was somebody who was in many senses uneasy. But having said that, it's also the case that many 18th century rulers were not exactly what we would regard as well adjusted. Peter the Great was responsible, after all, for the death of his own son, Tsarevich Alexis. The key difference in many respects about Frederick the Great was that he was successful.
When Frederick became king in 1740, his territories were still scattered like drops of oil across the map. East Prussia centred around Königsberg, then Brandenburg around Berlin, and in the west a set of tiny lands including Clever and Ravensburg. Compared to other German-speaking states such as Austria and Saxony, Prussia was a backwater. But what Frederick inherited was a highly militarized state, and the aim was to put it to immediate use, to fix Prussia firmly on the map. Running a poor country with no natural borders, you could argue that he had no other choice. Michael Stürmer again.
Well, if you are living in a kind of desert, and Brandenburg is sand, 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 wherever you look, then you cannot have a rich agriculture. The Saxons had the mountains and the silver and gold and all those riches and the metallurgical industries deriving from there. So there were serious competitors.
If you were to look at North Germany and the wider Baltic world, you would not necessarily assume that Prussia was going to be the dominant power. The Wettins of Saxony become kings of Poland. The Guelphs of Hanover get the British throne. And there are links between the Holstein-Gottorps and the throne of Russia, the Romanovs. If you were looking for a political identity that didn't focus on Vienna, you might have put your bet on Munich and the Wittelsbachs. You might have put your bet on Dresden and the Wettins. But there was no inherent reason why you should put your bet on Berlin and the Hohenzollerns.
Dresden, the Saxon capital, is just 2 hours south of Berlin. But in the 18th century, it was Prussia's biggest rival in what we can only loosely call Germany.
When you come to Dresden as a British person, you can't help but think about the RAF and the bombing. But to many Central Europeans, Dresden means something very, very different. For a long time, it was the sort of fun capital of Europe, rather like Barcelona is today. People would come here for festivals, sometimes that went on for 5, 6, 7 days. They'd watch firework displays that lasted for 5 hours. But it was also quite a powerful place. The ruler of Saxony, for example, was also king of Poland. And he would vie with his neighbor to the north, the king of Prussia, for dominance in this area. Sometimes they tangled with each other militarily, usually to the detriment of Saxony.
Können Sie uns beschreiben, wovor wir jetzt stehen? Mhm. Was ist das eigentlich für ein Modell?
Wir stehen vor einem Modell des Neumarktes in Dresden.
In the City Museum in Dresden, Dr. Maike Günther shows me a stunning model of the city in its 18th century heyday. Dr. Günther is immediately engaging and keen to draw a line between the Saxons and her Prussian neighbours to the north, who she dismisses at one point in our discussion as lacking any real sense of style. An unexpected comment, perhaps, but old rivalries rarely die. We've already seen how Frederick built up Prussia's cultural reputation, but his greatest achievements were military. He first stunned Europe by defeating the mighty Austrians. Then he turned his guns on his rivals closer to home. In 1760, the Prussians marched on the Saxon capital Dresden, shelled it indiscriminately, and moved on.
So Prussia and Saxony are competing culturally, diplomatically, militarily throughout much of the 18th century. Are either of them, though, thinking of the unification of Germany at this time?
Oh, eine recht schwierige Frage. Das ist zu zeitig gedacht.
Blimey, that's a really tough question. You're looking at this anachronistically. Nobody is thinking about dominating Germany at this time. The idea of a united Germany doesn't arise until the 19th century. These royal houses were just building up their own principalities. They were trying to make as good an impression as possible, but they were doing this in competition against the other princely houses.
So the thing to bear in mind is that there were different possible destinies for Germany. There were intellectuals in the 18th century talking about German identity, but the reality of it was Bavaria fighting the Austrians, the Prussians fighting the Saxons, so that, in other words, people could talk the language of Germany, just as, after all, they talked the language of Christendom, but didn't stop them killing each other.
If there's one defining characteristic of this tumultuous and explosive age, it's the ability of the numerous constituent parts to take each other on. And not just on the battlefield. Prussia wasn't alone in enjoying a cultural moment. There was Dresden, as we've heard, and Munich and Frankfurt, as well as the tiny city of Weimar, capital of Saxe-Weimar, 150 kilometres south of Berlin. In fact, cities right across the so-called Holy Roman Empire of the German nation were enjoying an astonishing renaissance. There were musicians like Bach and Haydn, and later on down in Salzburg, Mozart. The great inspiration behind the so-called German Enlightenment, the philosopher Immanuel Kant in Königsberg. and my own favourites Goethe and Schiller in tiny Weimar. Michael Stürmer again.
You had competition between various centres, and that was, among other things, a cultural competition, but it was also a technical competition. Then you had the competition between the two great religions. Then, of course, competition for support from outside, the English alliance or the French alliance. The Bavarian elector was traditionally a French ally. Frederick the Great was traditionally a British ally, sometimes the French, but he could change alliances like other people change their shirts. Then, of course, you had the Res Publica Literarum, the many centers. It's wonderful to see the dynamics of a place like London or Paris, but it's also fascinating to see a small, basically what we would call a village, like Weimar, becoming the cultural capital of Germany, a village of 6,000 people, of whom 1,000 more or less belonged to the court, and the rest were just farmers.
Well, it takes you about 5 minutes to walk through the centre of Weimar. And it's really hard to believe that not only was this the centre of German cultural life in the late 18th century, but it was the centre of European cultural life for a period. In this tiny little place, Goethe virtually invented the German novel. He virtually invented German drama, soon picked up on by his great friend Friedrich Schiller. And suddenly, from all over the continent, people wanted to come here and talk to the dramatists, talk to the poets, talk to the architects. Musicians like Bach had turned up earlier. It was an extraordinary potpourri of intellectual activity, a culture which brought together people speaking the same language but living in different territories, like Prussia, like Baden and Württemberg. Weimar became a symbol for all of them. All of which had huge implications for the future. At this stage, though, not even mighty Prussia's future was assured. Frederick the Great died in 1786, by which time he had increased the size of his kingdom considerably, particularly in capturing the rich lands of Silesia from the Habsburgs. But the kingdom he passed on to his successor was still only the 13th largest in Europe in terms of population and 10th in terms of size. And its fragility had been clearly highlighted when the Russians almost wiped it out. Norman Davis again.
The great moment, 1762, middle of the Seven Years' War, the Russians were on the point of taking Berlin. Prussia was a pest and it caused so much trouble, and we'll just do away with it.
And in what is known as the miracle of the House of Prussia, Frederick benefits from the fact that his great Russian opponent, Tsarina Elizabeth, drops down dead to be replaced by Peter III, who is in fact very pro-Prussian and who admires Frederick the Great.
The new Tsar of Russia is a Prussophile. He calls off the attack and Prussia survived, but it was the skin of their teeth. So another element of the 19th century story, that the rise of Prussia was preordained, is very much a myth.
We began this programme with a story about an inscription on a fountain in front of a church in Koblenz, marked in 1812 by the French moving east and in 1813 by the Russians moving west. A clear indication of just how much of German history has been shaped by invaders washing back and forth. Just as the Russians nearly wiped out Prussia in the Seven Years' War, so Napoleon almost killed off Germany before it had begun. He crossed the Rhine in 1805 with some 200,000 men. His first victories were against the Austrians and the Russians, notably at Austerlitz. Then on October the 14th, 1806, he encountered a joint Prussian-Saxon force. Two former enemies united against the French. But the Saxon-Prussian efforts were to end in humiliating defeat. I'm just north of the city of Jena in a room filled with memorabilia. You can see all sorts of things around us. A Prussian drum and a Prussian tunic. There are guns, there are swords, there are replica cannon. Very intricate models explaining why the Prussians and Saxons lost the Battle of Jena and Auerstedt in 1806. This was one of Napoleon's finest moments, and there's no doubting that the people here in Jena clearly admire Napoleon to quite a degree. And they've been explaining to me why Napoleon won this battle, but more importantly, why the Prussians and the Saxons lost it.
Und die sind natürlich den Truppen auch nicht so
gut. Das war ein paar Tage vorher.
Das war ein Tag vorher.
Ein Tag vorher haben sie das. Okay, this is absolutely fascinating. So Napoleon and his army were simply requisitioning food from the local population as they went along, a very pragmatic system. The Prussians had their more bureaucratic system of creating big supply depots of bread and grain and calculating how much each soldier needed every day and sending it to the front line. Now, there was so much chaos going on between the Prussians and the Saxons at this moment that the supply lines failed. And this was a critical difference. And the reason why it failed is because the armies were having to go backwards and forwards. They didn't know when, if they were going to engage. And the whole system was messed up. Perhaps you can tell me, how were the relations between the Saxon and the Prussian generals? Did they understand each other well?
Also, das Problem war damals, dass die Sachsen sich
The problem was that the Saxons were made to feel a touch inferior because they made up the smaller part of the joint force. Add to that the absence of a clear battle plan. In fact, 2 days before the conflict, the troops were still getting no food, particularly the Saxons. And so they threatened the Prussian general that unless something changed, they'd withdraw and leave the field of battle.
Keinerlei Verpflegung bekommen, insbesondere die Sachsen. Und die Sachsen haben also im Vorfeld dem preußischen General gedroht, wenn sich das nicht ändert, werden sie abziehen und die Armee verlassen.
So you could say that the failure of the Battle of Jena is a failure of German unity.
Yes, but in this time, Deutschland don't exist.
One of the things that's very noticeable is the degree to which there wasn't a united German response to the French.
Professor Jeremy Black.
At the time of Jena in 1806, both the Prussians and the Saxons are still fighting Napoleon. The Austrians have stopped by then. But there are enormous problems of logistics and cooperation on the battlefield and in the campaign. Problems that reflect a lack of common empathy. Jena is a humiliation.
One year later, a young Prussian soldier and military theorist, Karl Philipp Gottfried von Clausewitz, wrote an essay called The Germans and the French. In it, he compared the two sides. One, he said, was militaristic, the subject mentality of its people dooming them to obedience. The other had a more literary bent, its hypercritical inhabitants far less likely to submit to tyranny. The obedient militarists, incidentally, were the French, the critically minded literary types, the Germans. So much for national stereotypes. Except the Battle of Jena was the moment everything starts to change. Professor Michael Stürmer.
1806 is catastrophic. Not only in military terms, but also in moral terms. It is very clear the triumphal system of Frederick the Great is dead. And it was brain dead, at least for one generation.
Norman Davis again.
Look at Frederick the Great, the wonder king who put it all together. His legacy was almost lost in Napoleonic times.
What happened to Germany during the Napoleonic Wars?
Politically, Germany was in total meltdown. Prussia was decimated. Certainly a disaster for the pre-existing political order. The Holy Roman Empire, which had existed since the 10th century, disappeared from the map, 1806.
And having disposed of the empire, The French invader was now free to rationalize the mad jigsaw of individual states that had previously made up the German map. Literally hundreds of oddly shaped territories, many of which Napoleon gave to his newfound German allies, including, crucially, the Saxons after their defeat at Jena. By 1815, there were just 39 states left out of more than 400. Centuries of borders and divisions had been largely overturned. Simon Winder, author of Germania.
I think what's curious between the end of the 30 Years' War and the arrival of Napoleon, you have an uneasy standoff where everyone is sort of aware that the area which is now Germany is a helpless place, but that no one really wants to do anything about it. But when Napoleon arrives, not only does he militarily defeat the area which is now Germany, but more importantly, he realizes that he can bring on side collaborators. And suddenly it's like a kind of grotesque buffet gone wrong, with everyone just grabbing stuff left, right and center. Some of them are important states, but many of them are very small. And Napoleon really has no time at all for this stuff. And, of course, you know, his drawing on centuries of French disdain for this fragmented and feeble-minded little series of tiny statelets. But what he doesn't realise at the time, of course, he's creating the context in which Germany is going to become a much more powerful state than France.
One other massive change is underway. Prussia stares deep into the humiliation of Jena, but rather than side with Napoleon as others had done, Prussia decides to reform itself and fight on. Jeremy Black.
This feeds through into the propaganda about a German war of liberation, which is what they call it, against the French. A language that is proving particularly useful to the Prussians, because so many other German princely houses, one's thinking of the Saxons, one's thinking of the Bavarians, one's thinking of the Württembergers, had indeed gone on fighting for Napoleon. So in other words, German nationalism becomes a way to rally support to Prussia as an automatic leader of Germany.
Goethe, Schiller and the other intellectuals who had given such impetus to the idea of Germany had never suggested which state might bring this unification about. What Napoleon had done was to taint Prussia's rivals, particularly Saxony and Bavaria, with his support. Prussia, by contrast, was seen as unsullied, and it arose phoenix-like from the ashes of defeat to a triumphant role at Waterloo. Indeed, Germans will still tell you that it wasn't Wellington who won the battle, but General von Blücher. Prussia's emergence as a great power had begun, and in many ways it was the French who set them on their way.
The Invention of Germany was presented by Misha Glennie. The series is produced in Bristol by Miles Ward. And you might be interested in a programme tomorrow morning here on Radio 4. At 9:45, the historian and author Michael Stürmer, a former scriptwriter for Helmut Kohl, reflects on the German attitude towards the concept of Europe. That's the State of the Union tomorrow morning at 9:45. And just before that, Lise Doucette will be presenting another one-to-one interview.
For this week's edition of 1:1, I'm in Kabul to speak to Nader Nadiri. He's in his 30s, so he's never known his country at peace. When he was just 8, his school was destroyed in the war. In his 20s, he was arrested and tortured by the Taliban. Educated and able to...
You my woman and my only girl. Money won't change you.